The United Nations is the next arena to entertain debate for the Bush administration's war agenda. The U.S.'s proposal for a U.N. resolution to attack Iraq is facing an uphill battle in the U.N. Security Council. Stephen Zunis is the author of Tinderbox, U.S. Middle East Policy and the Roots of Terrorism. Zunis is Associate Professor of Politics at the University of San Francisco. Stephen, what's your reaction to the direction the Congress and the U.N. appear to be headed in on the question of granting Bush war powers against Iraq?
Well, one thing I'd mention is I think the Democrats are making a big mistake if they think that it's safer to err on the hawkish side than the dovish side. I see this as potentially doing to the Democratic Party what the Vietnam War did, dividing it very badly, and with the option of the Green Party nowadays, the Democrats should not count on getting the vote of everyone who is to the left of the Republicans, particularly the way they have spinelessly given in to President Bush's call for an illegal war.
You know, I think it's interesting that you raise that issue because I've also been wondering how they are calculating what the political fallout will be for them. On the one hand, the polls tend to say that most Americans have not lined up lockstep behind giving the president unilateral authority to declare war against Iraq, and yet they keep saying, well, you know, because they know that the elections are coming up and they don't want to vote too dovish on that issue. How do you see that?
Well, traditionally, Democrats believe that as long as they are just a tiny bit less conservative than the Republicans, they'll get the liberal and progressive vote, particularly given how scary many Republicans have been in recent years. At the same time, this sense that it's easier to err on the hawkish side than the dovish side is going to be negated if this war ends up being more problematic than the Bush administration is making out to be, which it almost certainly will.
So you think they're miscalculating this?
Very much so, very much so.
Is it likely that people will vote on this single issue?
Perhaps not, but it will certainly be an issue on the minds of many people. I know quite a few whom it will be a single issue because it's more than just a war. In fact, it is an abrogation of the United Nations Charter and the basic principles of liberal internationalism that have been built up in international legal systems and organizations in the past century, ironically by such Democrats as Woodrow Wilson and Franklin Roosevelt. This, however, is so blatant, so overt, this idea that we had the right to invade a sovereign country and overthrow its government and put in one more to our liking because they might be making weapons that might someday be used against us, that just throws the past century of international law out the window and is literally reactionary, bringing us back to some 19th century notion of right of conquest.
President Bush said in his Cincinnati address Monday night that granting him the power to unilaterally attack Iraq does not mean that war is imminent. It simply will allow the United Nations and the world to know that Americans speak with one voice. Now, my question is, are the Security Council members of the UN likely to be persuaded by a congressional resolution?
It's difficult to say. There's a possibility that with the U.S. resolution, which actually overturns previous resolutions the United States supported, will be seen by some nations as the best hope for stopping a U.S. invasion. However, the wording of the resolution is such that it will be very easy for the United States to use it as an excuse to invade anyway, this time with the stamp of approval of the world body. So I'm sure the nations and the Security Council are struggling with this very issue, complicated by the fact the United States is doing quite a bit of arm twisting, literally bribery and extortion, to get the votes needed to pass their resolution.
And there's also this ongoing debate about whether the U.S. sanctions against Iraq, which have killed over 1.5 million Iraqi men, women, and children, according to their ambassador, whether or not they are actually legal.
There are serious questions about whether this kind of enforcement is legal given the nature of the violation. But in addition to the legal and moral questions to deal with it, the main impact it's had from a political perspective is it strengthened Saddam Hussein. We hear all this talk about regime change, but Remember that in the past 20, 30 years, the vast majority of regime changes against dictatorial regimes from Eastern Europe to Southeast Asia to Africa to Latin America to the Middle East has taken place through people power, largely nonviolent movements from below, from the people themselves, ousting their governments. And the trouble with the sanctions is that, for one thing, it's destroyed the middle class, reducing them to poverty or forcing them to emigrate, and they've been key figures in most of these people power movements. It's made people all the more dependent upon the regime for rations and the like, so it makes it even less likely for them to rebel. And it's created a new class of black marketeers who have a stake in maintaining the status quo. So if we were really interested in regime change, we would have stopped the sanctions some years ago and allowed the Iraqi people themselves to overthrow Saddam Hussein.
Any final thoughts on your part, Stephen Zunis?
This really is a pivotal moment. What's going to be happening in the next few weeks on Capitol Hill, in the United Nations, and elsewhere. And the more that the American people resist, the more Americans are outspoken in their opposition, the less likely the war will take place, and the less likely that if it does, it will be as devastating as it might otherwise be. And we now know that the demonstrations against the Vietnam War and against U.S. intervention in Central America, while at the time seemed futile, based on documents we have since seen, they actually prevented rather dramatic escalations in these wars and eventually led to negotiated settlements. So people should not feel hopeless. People should not resign themselves to this war because we still have an impact. We can still make a difference, and we can still prevent this from being the first of a whole series of imperial adventures, which will destabilize the world even further.
So people hearing you might say, what can we do at this point? The Congress is poised to pass the resolution, and the UN Security Council is likely to do the same.
Well, I can only think back of the spring of 1970 when the United States invaded Cambodia. 300 colleges and universities shut down a full 6 weeks before commencement. There was massive civil disobedience. Hundreds of thousands descended upon Washington within a couple of weeks, and the result was a withdrawal of American forces from Cambodia by the end of June. And it was a remarkable show of what massive civil disobedience and resistance can do. We can see that again. I've spoken to a number of college campuses in the past couple of weeks, and I have been very impressed with the energy that the students have demonstrated. I think they, along with people from older generations, can take this on directly, take to the streets, and really, through mass nonviolent action, make it clear that the cost of this invasion are far greater than the administration and its congressional supporters think it's going to be.
I think some Americans may feel a reluctance to go to war, but haven't connected the dots, don't really know what the cost to them personally might be.
I think it would be pretty obvious, I think, financially. Where are we going to get the $100 or $200 billion to pay for this? I think certainly the casualties will be far greater, the different kind of war than we've seen the American servicemen and women fight in recent years. I think also it's going to raise the questions of what's going to happen afterwards, and in terms of the length of U.S. involvement and what we might get involved in, the chaos of post-war Iraq. I definitely think that we need to make it clear how costly this will be, and as the more people are aware of this, the more they will resist.
Stephen Zunis, University of San Francisco professor and editor of the Foreign Policy in Focus Project, we caught up with him at the Phoenix airport. Yesterday, Russia, a permanent member of the Security Council with veto power, rejected the U.S.'s proposal, stating it contained knowingly unfulfillable demands. Instead, Russia is backing the French proposal in which Iraq would be given a chance to cooperate with U.N. weapons inspections and the use of force would be reserved for a second U.N. resolution if Iraq doesn't comply. WPFW's Reem Kathuta spoke with François Reveseau, spokesman for the French Foreign Ministry in Paris, about France's position with regards to Iraq.
We want the international community acting as one united force to ensure that the possible proliferation of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq is made impossible. We believe that the best way to ensure that is to give the inspectors the possibility to go back in Iraq with a strong hand, with a very firm capacity of going where they want, as they want, without constraints, without difficulties in Iraq.
The inspectors left Iraq some 4 years ago, and Mr. Ritter was part of the inspectors' team, and he says that by then Iraq was 95% disarmed.
The inspectors, since 91, 92 till 98, were in Iraq with Mr. Ritter, and they have destroyed much more weapons of mass destruction during their stay there than the war operations. So in our view, this is a good reason to say and build the case about the efficiency of the inspectors. These inspectors are not prevented to conduct their inspections without difficulties, then they can be efficient.
You highlighted the importance of a United Security Council and one that will be patient to have the mechanism of the United Nations function. Yet, the President of the United States is declaring that if the Security Council doesn't move fast enough, the United States will take action. What is the French comment on that?
For the time being, we are working in the United Nations framework. The last speech of President Bush has confirmed this option, and we consider the option which will prove more efficient also if you take into account the possible repercussions in the region. In the opinion of the Arab world, it is important that they know that what the UN Security Council does in Iraq is supported by the whole international community. So it gives a lot of legitimacy to the action which could be taken at one point if Iraq doesn't comply. It makes things very clear and very simple to understand. And this is very important for the future, because whatever can happen, if we keep on this route of United Nations, we keep on the road which ensures that in the long term there will be no counterproductive effects of the actions which has to be taken to ensure that Iraq complies with its obligation in terms of non-proliferation.
The people in Europe, we heard, were demonstrating against the war. How does the foreign ministry in France consider that as a weight in some of its decisions of foreign policy?
It's not a subject causing such mobilization in the French public. I have not seen very big demonstration till now in France. But this doesn't mean that this will not be the case if we went closer to a situation of conflict. But at this stage, we are working in the UN Security Council along the lines that I have indicated, and I think there is general support to this line in France.
Reporter Reem Karhouta from Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington, speaking with Francois Rivesseau, spokesman for the French Foreign Ministry in Paris. The dictionary defines patriotism as love or devotion for one's country. In recent years, the term has come to be measured by flag waving or uncritical support of a president during times of conflict. But some members of Congress believe true patriotism also includes the exercise of dissidence and free-flowing debate. Robert Knight from WBAI has this report.
California Representative Barbara Lee came face to face with the conflict between national chauvinism and constitutional duty last year when she stood alone with the sole vote in the House of Representatives against granting full presidential authority for an immediate and unlimited war in the wake of the September 11th attacks. Lee says the Constitution itself requires that there be informed debate on matters of war and peace.
It's very patriotic to offer a different point of view. Central to our democracy is the right to dissent. We want to protect American young men and women's lives and Iraqi civilians' lives. If we don't offer a point of view and engage in a debate, you have one point of view only prevailing, and that is not the democratic way. That is not the American way. It's very patriotic to uphold our Constitution even in a time of national security crisis. And that is the American way, and that is what I each and every day talk about with my colleagues. And many of them recognize that, many of them understand that, and many of them are adhering to that. And I think you see more debate this year, more debate in the last few weeks. than you have seen in the last year and a half.
Barbara Lee, who represents Oakland and Berkeley in the San Francisco Bay Area, has introduced, along with 36 more members, an amendment to the proposed House authorization for a military attack on Iraq. Meanwhile, upstate New York Representative Maurice Hinchey feels that the current debate scheme with alternating Republicans and Democrats dilutes congressional debate so that a unilateral Republican Party line, along with philosophical splits among the Democrats, means that only one quarter of the voices heard can give meaningful dissent to the current clamor for military action. Hinchey, too, says that his opposition is deeply patriotic and his largely conservative constituency understands that.
People that I represent are patriotic, as I think most people are, almost all people are across this country. I'm patriotic myself. I love my country. And because I love my country, I have to stand up and express my views when I believe that the leadership of my country is making a terrible mistake that is detrimental to the interests of my country and to others. And I think that that is precisely what is happening in this case. I think that the Bush administration is taking us in a bad direction. It's bad for a great many reasons, because, first of all, it's dishonest, it's hypocritical, it's deeply cynical, and it is going to be terribly costly. It'll be costly in terms of our relations with other people in the Middle East and elsewhere around the world. It will be costly if this resolution is prosecuted in the form of the loss of life, including significant numbers of Americans as well as others. And it is costly in terms of the amount of money it's going to cost us, perhaps 100 to as much as $200 billion. That's the estimate that was given to us by Lawrence Lindsay and the administration. And worst of all, it's deeply costly in terms of our own polity, in terms of what this country is and what it ought to be. It's deeply costly in terms of the fact that it runs contrary, this resolution, and the way that this administration is conducting itself runs contrary to the American Constitution, the basic principles upon which the country is based. And the Congress is being asked essentially to violate the Constitution, and the Congress is falling in line. That is very deeply costly. And to stand by while these things are going on and not express opposition to them is deeply unpatriotic. It is deeply patriotic to stand up and call it what it is. Dissent is the essence of democracy. If you have no dissent, you have no democracy. If you have no right to dissent, democracy is gone. And there are people in this administration who have attempted to equate dissent with a lack of patriotism. The moment we let anyone get away with that, that's the moment when the essence of what is the United States and has been for 227 years goes out the door.
Representative Maurice Hinchey of New York's 26th Congressional District. In New York City, I'm Robert Knight.
Among the more passionate calls for peace during Tuesday's debate was that of Georgia Democratic Representative John Lewis.
Mr. Speaker, my colleagues, I rise to speak against this resolution. I rise to speak for peace. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. Today we must ask ourselves, will we sow the seeds of peace, or are we just another nation sowing the seeds of war? What fruit will our actions bear? Not just for us, but for our children, and not just for the children of our own land, for the children of the West and the Middle East and the world. What do our children gain when we have destroyed another nation? What do we gain when we have killed hundreds and thousands of their men, women, and children, when hundreds of our sons and daughters have died? War with Iraq will not bring peace to the Middle East. It will not make the world a safer, a better, a more loving place. It will not end the strife and hatred that breed terror. War does not end strife. It sows seeds. War does not end hatred. It feeds it. War is bloody. It is vicious. It is evil. And it is messy. We must heed the words of the spiritual. I'm going to lay my burden down by the riverside. I ain't going to stir that war no more. For those who argue that war is a necessary evil, I say you're half right. War is evil, but it is not necessary. War cannot be a necessary evil because nonviolence is a necessary good. The two cannot coexist. America's ingenuity, freedom, and democracy have conquered the world. It is a battle that we do not win with guns or tanks or missiles, but with ideas, principles, and justice. We must use our resources not to make bombs and guns, but to solve the problem that affects humankind. We must feed the stomach, close the naked bodies, educate and stimulate the mind. We must use our resources to build and not to tear down, to reconcile and not to divide, to love and not to hate, to heal and not to kill. This is the direction in which a great nation should move. War is easy, but peace is hard. I know it's not easy to love thy enemy. No peace is hard. So we have war in Israel and no peace. We have war in Kashmir, but no peace. We have war in Afghanistan, in Colombia, in Sudan, in the Philippines, and no peace. It may be hard, it may be difficult, but the quest for peace is as old as the dawn of history and as fresh as the morning newspaper. My colleagues, my brothers and sisters, sometimes, someplace, leaders of a great nation, we have the courage to say we will lay down the burden, the tools, and instrument of war. We will wage peace and not war. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
U.S. Representative John Lewis of Georgia on the floor of the House. Spoken word artist Steve Connell from the Underground Poets Railroad exercises his right to speak out in this piece brought to us by KPFK in Los Angeles.
This one's called I Disagree. I am an American. I have the right to remain silent. I wish to refuse that right. And if you refuse that right, then everything you say can and will be used against you. Well, I am a poet also, so that's what I fucking want. I am a poet and an American. In the mouth of poets, words are like actions. They define you. And if your words don't define you, then why the fuck are you talking? If you ain't trying to go forward, then why the fuck are you walking? You should sit down and shut up, and you have that right. But I'm a poet and an American, and my pencil sparks light with each word that I write, and I will stand there and fight to the dawn's early light. As the bombs burst in air, I'ma stand right there, and I'ma speak my fucking mind. I got that right. I am an American. Truthfully, in the truth you never fully told and still don't tell, but I tell the truth of who you are because I am who you are. I am an American, and I tell the truth. I am old women in department stores, built atop the consecrated bones of Crazy Horse. I sign credit card receipts like treaties. I don't intend to honor a legacy of a debt that can never be repaid. I am restitution for the sweet dreams that can't come to the children who died because, hush, little baby, don't say a word. And you can't say a word because we built a Sears atop your grave. So you can't talk about the blanket soaked with smallpox that the government gave. I am the dead Indian baby swaddled in smallpox who watched the chickens come home. I, Malcolm X, I am not here to condemn America. I am here to tell the truth. And if the truth condemns America, well, she stands condemned. I am the bones of the men and the women that fell to ocean bottom like tracks of the Underground Railroad that led the wrong way to freedom. I am all the blank walls standing tall, a middle passage memorial to the names we don't know. I am Japanese American citizens standing in U.S. internment camps, concentrating on blank walls, remembering Harriet Tubman and slow dancing with the ghosts of Cherokees in prison in Alcatraz before they admitted Alcatraz was a prison and they called it a reservation. I am America. And if you say I'm wrong, if there is nothing, if we are not our history, if there is nothing but our present, then we must re-examine our scriptures with an eye for historical context, look at our Constitution with a mind to reaffirm, for we are not created equal until we say so. No commandments are contractually binding. Our rights are alienable again, and freedom isn't certain. But this is, I am an American, and I pledge allegiance to no flag, and our states are not united until the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, I say to you this, there could be no one nation under God unless that nation is the world. Because God made the world and man-made nations. And if God were to honor man-made nations, he would do so with this condition, that he honor them all equally the way he made them. So to pledge to one is to pledge against others, and to pledge against others is to pledge against God. And I am not ready to go to war with God. And despite the fact that I think war is wrong, Johnny Ashcroft, I am an American, and I will not be silent. I will not be silent because you will be. I will not be silent because you disagree with me. I will not be silent because you think it wrong to disagree with my country. You should read the Bill of Rights and understand it was my country's idea. I am an American, and I will not be silent, and you should use this speech against me.
Spoken word artist Steve Connell from the Underground Poets Railroad, brought to us by KPFK in Los Angeles. Listening to Imperatives for Peace, Pacifica's Peace Watch. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Tonight's engineer was Rolando Arrieta. Our editor is Reem Kathuda from WPFW. Our associate producers are Fidel Rodriguez of KPFK, Renee Feltz of KPFT, and Robert Knight of WBAI. Sam Husseini and Larry Binsky are consultants to this program. We had production assistance from Sidrak Franklin and Laurel Paget-Seekins at WPFW, Christopher Sprinkle of KPFK, and David Russo of the DC Indie Media Center. Our webmaster is Pete Caracas. For copies of Peace Watch, go to www.pacificaarchives.org. That's www.pacificaarchives.org, or call 1-800-735-0230. We'd love to hear your feedback on the program. Send us your comments to peacewatch@pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thank you for listening.